Welcome to another episode of Living an Ultra Life. My name is Mike, and I would listen to this podcast with a pen and a piece of paper. This week, we are joined by one of the people that I just absolutely, absolutely love and have been wanting to get this dude on the podcast probably since I first met him. Finally got him on, and we are going to celebrate his victory at one of the hardest 100-milers in the world, probably the hardest 100-miler in the United States. Kyle, you ready to go for a run?
I'm ready to go for a run. I'm recovered still, but yes, I'm ready to go for a run.
That is awesome. That is awesome. Well, dude, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you? What kind of strange things do you do? All that good stuff. Family.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, my name is Kyle, and grew up in Colorado. Went into the Navy right out of high school, and had a really successful career there. Got into the ultra running about 5 years ago. It's kind of a funny story because I actually was not a huge fan of running at the time, and one of the guys at my church had been running a particular run. And so what I wanted to do was kind of surprise him. So I trained for a half marathon. I know it's crazy. And it was very long, 13.1 miles in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, it's relative to who the runner is. And that was a very long distance for me when I was first starting out. And I just remember showing up on the start line. It was the Shamrock half marathon right here in wonderful Virginia Beach. And just to see the look on his face, it was awesome. And it was so worth it. And from there, I just continued to increase the mileage. And I thought, hey, what the heck, man, I'm just going to go for a 50K. So I skipped the whole marathon piece, went right into a 50K, which was the High Bridge. And I remember coming across that finish line and telling my wife, I'm never going to do this again. And sure enough, you know, I was on Ultra Sign Up, you know, a few days later looking for the next race. And I think it just, the story goes on and on and on. And yeah, man, Ray. Yeah. So like I said, it's been about 5 years, and Ray 100 was kind of a huge milestone for me. And one of those challenges, not just due to the difficulty, but man, just the beauty of the mountain range out there is absolutely beautiful. The San Juans and their relentless mountains. And I just wanted to give it everything that I got and see if I had what it took. And I did.
Yes, you did. So you're married, Tanya, and you have one son, correct?
Yep, correct. Married, one son. And then I have a wonderful daughter as well. Yeah, we live out here.
I always forget that.
Yeah.
No, sorry. Tell her I apologize.
That's okay. She'll forgive me.
That's awesome. And so now where did you and Tanya meet? Is she from Colorado also?
No, she's not. She's a country gal. And so she's actually, I met her out here on a blind date, and it was at a little restaurant called Federico's. If you remember, it's this little Italian joint up near the boulevard. Yep. And we headed off, and yeah, we started a family from there, and it was great. Married shortly after that. And we've been married 19 years. We're coming up on 20 this May 4th. So pretty
awesome.
Cool.
That's exciting. All right. So started ultras. Like that was like 2019 or 2020?
Yeah, 2019.
Okay. So jumped into the 50K. And now what was it about the ultra distance that sort of captured you? Because you just kept coming back.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think what I am absolutely mesmerized by is, first of all, just how the body can go well beyond what the mind can think. And so I think unlocking that human potential from a mental perspective is one of the things that I gravitate towards, or that it was very attractive for me and to me while I was doing ultra running. So that was it. I also love how you got to kind of, it's like a game of chess. You got to figure out, you know, do I need fuel? Do I need more electrolytes? Do I need more water? What's going on? Why are my legs working? And it's working through the low spots and celebrating the high spots, you know, the roller coaster of ultra running, how you're feeling. and what the body is doing. And I think that it's all of those things. It's a kind of a cumulative effect of all of those that really kind of draw me towards or into this sport. And it's awesome, man. And finding God throughout it is critical, at least in my life. It's very helpful when I can just get in sync and in tune and be with Him while I'm running. I feel like miles just start falling off when I'm focused on Him. So yeah, it's awesome.
And you've run some really tough stuff because you've done both the Cloud Splitter 100K and 100 miler, right?
That's correct. Yeah, my very first 100 miler was Bryce Canyon. And so I did it with a couple of my buddies, Adam and Chris. And man, it's just so gorgeous being out there. The mountains are just there. It's beautiful, man, in Utah. And the air is just, it's super clean. And the runners are fun. They're friendly. Most of them, they're out there. Everybody's trying to achieve this common goal. And so, yeah, that was the first one. And it was tough. I think it had around 14,000 feet of elevational gain and descent, and it had some altitude added as well. I think it started around 7,000 feet. Don't quote me on that, though. It's been a while since I looked back on that race, but that was the first victory and or first 100-mile victory, I should say. And it was neat. That was a cool race for sure.
And not a bad course too. It's kind of tricky. It goes through some beautiful parts of Utah though, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, you have this like high desert. It starts off kind of in this high desert barren area, for probably around the first 50K or so. And I'm not sure if they've changed the course, but when I ran it, that's what it was like. You did a big loop and then you kind of head up into a different part of the mountains where then you start to get some tree cover and it gets very rocky. And just these beautiful buttes and cliffs that you're running on top of. It was beautiful. The colors, especially when the sun was coming down, just kind of amplified all of that scenery. It was neat. So
Cool.
I definitely focused a lot on that. And of course, like I said, I had my buddy Adam who was running with me, and he was, man, that guy can climb. So I learned a lot
Awesome.
about that. Yeah.
That is cool. So now, when did you start to focus in on you, Ray? Because I've known you, I guess, since about 2022. Is that when we met?
Yeah, 2022. So, I had big dreams and aspirations to actually, I wanted to run UTMB, and as I continued to get older, that vision kind of went away, but they had changed the rules. I actually had all the qualifications in terms of the races that I needed to run and enough points. And then it became, it's a lottery system, and I understand that. And so, they had changed the rules shortly afterward. Then you needed to run, UTMB specific races to get gemstones. And I was like, man, I just did all of that work for ran those races. I decided, you know what, I'm gonna put that off and try to do the next what I think is the hardest thing, and that was in Ouray, Colorado. As funny as it is, too, I grew up in Colorado. I had never ever been to Ouray, and so I was like, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna totally do this. So I was on the wait list last year, and I got an invite about a week prior, which is I just can't jump through hoops like that, my lifestyle. So I had to put that off last year, and then I was able to run it this year. So that's kind of the, I guess, the timeline for your Ray.
And that required that you had to requalify, right? So you had to get another 100 miler with some elevation. And tell us a little bit about the qualifications for you, right? Because you do have to kind of do something that's a little bit of a stretch, right?
Yeah, so if you look on their website, you had to do at least 90 miles during a 24-hour race, where you had to complete. They have a list of very, very difficult races that are out there that are also qualifiers. And off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you all of those. But then the other one was, hey, you needed to complete a single track 100-mile foot race. So I set out. And I think it was you and I actually. I was going to try to qualify with Tideland 24-hour race, and ran into some issues where for the first time ever, I got really dehydrated. I remember waking up that morning and thinking to myself, boy, it's going to be hot. If you've ever been on the East Coast, for all the folks that are listening, even though it was in November, we just had a real hot, muggy spell that morning. And I got dehydrated, started urinating blood off and on around 20 miles or so. And it would go away and then it would come back, go away, come back. And I think just shy of 50 miles, the urine was basically pure blood. So we decided to call that race, which kind of made it tricky because there weren't a lot of other 100-mile options out there in terms of races to be able to qualify and give myself rest to be able to be prepared for Ouray. So it was kind of tricky navigating that. But I ended up finding a race, and it was the MST 100 Rally Durham, North Carolina, just north up around Falls Lake. Beautiful. But boy, it was a ruddy, ruddy race where the ground was just obscured by those tree roots that you can't see, but your feet will find them, and you'll end up smashing your face right into the trail. I took a bunch of falls. In fact, I took one at around 30, end up really bruising, if not breaking, one of my right ribs. And so for the next 70 miles, I was kind of huffing and eking my way through the race, but got it done, and that qualified me up for Ouray 100.
Which then presented the other challenge for, coming from Flatlanderville. How do you train for Ouray 100, which is, did it end up being like, was it 40,000 feet of climb? I always forget how much climb. It seems like you endlessly climb in it, but how much elevation gain did you have in that?
So yeah, the elevational gain and descent. So you've got 41,863 feet of gain and 41,863 feet of descent. Yeah, so okay, because you're a Virginia Beachian, we have a little pile of trash that used to be an old trash site that they turned into a park called Mount Trashmore. And I spent hours, I'm talking hours, just doing hill repeats. I found some of the toughest kind of sections in terms of steepness. So it was pretty cool. There's probably about four or five different aspects, like in terms of incline, that you can kind of train on. So I was out there at least two, if not three times per week. And then some of my long runs, I would incorporate out there just for hours at a time, going up and down that mountain. And it works. That's the crazy thing is it actually really, really works. So I did a lot of that. And then I also tried to incorporate some very, very long runs on the weekend, where I was up probably just over a marathon up into probably, I think 32 miles was the highest that I went. And right before I started my taper, total amount, I got right about 68 miles total from a cumulative perspective. And about 13,500 feet of vertical gain that week. So, yeah, you got it. I think in order to be successful in this, and we can talk a little bit more about it because these thoughts definitely came up while I was running Ouray. You've got to pound that vert. You just have got to get out there and get climbing. It's a very unique race. It's very steep. It's relentless. The climbs. And you just really got to do a lot of focusing on that. I also did a lot of strength workouts. So I did kettlebell swings, goblet squats, step ups on boxes. We have a Jacob's ladder. It's kind of an evil device that sits at probably about, I don't know, maybe 25, 30 degrees, these rungs of ladders that just kind of circulate around. So I definitely did. I did some time at least once a week. I was doing that or stair stepper. I would go out to buildings and run up the stairs. I'd find a building that was 175 feet tall and just run up and down the stairs for hours at a time to prepare pull my kit on. So those are, I think, the things that I utilized for my training anyway to be successful. And I also think that just running in a very hot and humid environment definitely will help as well to kind of prepare you for this race. It makes being at 5,000 feet anyway a little bit easier to navigate. Once you get above 10,000, though, boy, things start to change around 10, 10-5 for sure.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Your training was solid. I mean, you were very, very disciplined. You spent a lot of time trying to get your feet off of pavement and onto the surface that you're going to be running on. Was there a point to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I tried to definitely State Park. I failed to mention that. So State Park, getting on trails, specifically on Mount Trashmore too, running not just even up and down, but laterally, just because of the grades that you're going to be running on in your race. And what was really great, Charles, who's the race director, just did an amazing job of describing, the sections. He breaks down the Ouray 100 race into 16 sections, and he talks a little bit about what to expect. Hey, this is going to be a Jeep 4x4 trail. This is where it really starts to get rocky. There's these sections where the rocks are so loose, it's like running on ball bearings. Be very, very careful through, these particular sections. This is what to expect. So I think that when I read that, I tried to mimic a lot of my training. I actually even got into soft sand, which I know a lot of folks don't like running in, but I think that it really helped to strengthen up all my ligaments, especially around in my ankles, just because the footing, you don't get real firm footing there. So your ankles are going to roll. And I think the testament of that is that I didn't have any ankle rolls. I didn't have any falls out there. And I felt like I could really navigate the trail systems when I could run, if I wasn't climbing or hoofing for air. I felt really, really strong and injury free during that whole entire race. I wasn't the fastest guy. I was, towards the rear of the pack, which is really like mid pack. I'm kind of like a mid pack runner, but it's just that just kind of goes to show you how difficult that race is. You need to be mid pack or in front to make it through there. So
So I think your training is a real testament toward what it takes to make a Ouray type of race happen, because you were very disciplined in your training, very, very focused on what it was going to take. And so take us out to Colorado now, because you went out a little bit early, right? So
I did.
kind of take us into what your approach and your mindset was. As now you've successfully tapered, and now you need to get out to Colorado, and I know that's a tough assignment, having to go out to the beauty of Colorado, but take us out into to Colorado.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so I went out a week prior and flew into Denver, spent a few nights with my sister and her roommate. And so that was at 5,000 feet, just to acclimate. I did some runs around there. They have one particular run out by Red Rocks Park. It's Mount Falcon, and it was awesome. And I went out there, and it was super hot out. Knocked that out. It was about 8 miles, and that was kind of the end of my race. And I felt really good. And there's some very steep sections in that. So that was kind of like from a mental perspective, I just wanted to get that last little kind of stint of, hey, I'm coming from wooded, swampy area to now I'm in the mountains. So like, boop, let's make the shift mentally. So I felt really good with that. And then just kind of started to taper and relax and just do some really light runs around there. Then I went up to stay with one of my buddies. He lives up in Evergreen. So I went up to the next kind of elevational set. He's about 7,500 feet. And then I had a rental car and zipped out to Grand Junction to pick up a camper. Got a camper on Outdoorsy. It was a 27-foot like RV, drivable
Cool.
RV. And then I went into Ouray, Colorado. So now I'm in Ouray, Colorado on Monday. And man, I'm going to tell you, Mike, when I you can see these mountains as you're driving from Montrose. So it's Grand Junction, and then you go down into Montrose, and shortly after Montrose, you can see the San Juan Mountains just rising. And I mean, they're massive. And when I finally pulled the camper into Ouray, I mean, my first initial thought was, I am out of my element here. Like, these mountains are something else. It really truly is like the Switzerland of America. Oh man, it was beautiful. And I have been to Switzerland, parts of it. And that's the closest thing I can tell the listeners here. These mountains are just, I mean, they're gorgeous, but boy, they are a force to be reckoned with. They just come straight out of the ground and just rise for thousands of feet. Yeah, I actually was really a little bit worried. One of my pacers came out early with me. His name was Rich, and I'm so thankful for him. He came up with this idea to rent a razor, which is like one of those little Polaris razor 4x4s, so we could kind of go up into the mountains and do a little recon of the area
Oh,
where I was going to
cool.
be running. Yeah, really, really cool.
Yeah, because
So,
those you got to have something, because those roads, those
whoo.
oh my gosh, I don't even know how to describe them.
Yeah, I
Adventure
mean,
trails, I don't know.
it quickly goes from, I can drive a vehicle to on a nice paved road, the $6 million or the $1 million highway, they call it, which is a whole nother thing we'll talk about. There's no guardrails, man, on the side of this mountain going up some of these passes, like going up into the
And the
Ironton Eight
drops are not
Station.
small. It's not like 100 feet.
Oh, it's like thousands of feet straight down. And I was telling my wife Tanya, I'm like, hey, don't be scared when you got to drive the camper up here. But there's not a lot of room, and pay attention, because, man, there's just not even enough room to put a guardrail up there. You're going right off the mountain. It's still, but just the views are just absolutely stunning and breathtaking. That area is absolutely amazing. But what I was going to say, sorry, back to the roads. There'll be some regular roads, and then they quickly turn into just very technical four-wheel drive, the Jeeps. So the Razor was able to navigate those roads very, very well, and we were able to scope out a bunch of that area. And what was neat, Mike, and the whole reason why I bring this up is that when I was able to see that, it took a little bit of the fear away from just being in the valley of the mountains and looking at them, and then actually getting up into them and seeing them. My thoughts then changed to, hey man, I can do this. Like, I can do this. These are mountains. I can run these mountains. They're steep. It's going to be bananas, but I can do this. So it was neat to see that from a mental
Awesome.
perspective. You and I both know, man, running, right? It's all up in the top side there, especially once you go blow through 30 miles. I mean, it's all in your head. So,
Yeah, that's where the Yogi Berra quote, comes into play, right? When Yogi Berra said about baseball that it's 90% mental and the other 50% is physical. So it's a great quote. It applies to ultra running. So you kind of brought together a good crew and some good pacers, right? So tell us a little bit about the team that you assembled.
Okay, yeah. Well, what I wanted to do too, if you don't mind, and I'll talk to about
No
the
problem.
team. The so on I spent one night at Ouray. Sits at 7,700 feet. And so we spent the night there in the camper, right in the campground. It's called like 4J Camping. Great campground, well maintained. The bathrooms were immaculate. They were clean. The people were just absolutely friendly.
And it
It's
wasn't
such a
very full, right?
it no, it was pretty full. It was
Was it? Okay.
pretty packed out.
So that's gotten more popular out there then.
Yeah, it definitely has gotten more popular. But the next two nights, we drove the camper up to by pretty much Ironton Aid Station, and there's some
Wow.
Bureau of Land Management. The BLM owns a bunch of land up there, and you can do what's called dry camping. So we were able to just kind of take the camper and found this stream, and you get this beautiful view of Ironton Mountain. And I mean, it's gorgeous up there, man. Absolutely gorgeous. And so I spent two nights at about 90, 9,500 feet, give or take, somewhere in that area. And then the last night I came back down and just spent the night at 7,700 feet. And I say
And
all of
that's
that because,
actually a really good thing because, I mean, one of the things they say is sleeping at altitude actually helps you to acclimate better.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of all the research. I had some other friends of mine tell me, hey, that's going to be the best way for your body to make blood cells. I think at the end of the day, you really, man, if you really wanted to do well, and there are just some people, I guess, that can adapt quicker. I'm 40, almost 48 years old now, so my body doesn't adjust as quick, but I think that you would need 3 good weeks to kind of acclimate at those altitudes if you really wanted to, do well in that race in terms of like if you wanted to do better than just finish, and if you had a certain goal in mind, I think
Right.
that would help out. So, and I also utilized, it's called Beat Elite, and basically it's nitric oxide. I utilize some of that to also help my body with the uptake of oxygen and increased a little bit of iron as well as a supplement. All of those things I think definitely help me out. But like I said, when you get around 10.5, 10.8, or 11, it's you my body anyway, it was hard to get the oxygen into my body, and muscles were burning. But I think that it all helped. I wanted to throw that comment in
Oh
there.
yeah,
So,
definitely.
that are trying to figure out. I had some pacers, and we can talk about that, who came from sea level. And I was a little bit concerned about that when I was putting my crew together, just because of their work schedules. They were not able to come out to acclimate, for a very long time.
Yeah.
And there are kind of two trains of thoughts where some people say, hey, no, it's better to just, if you can't do 3 weeks or more, it's better to just come out and then just go for it, because you're getting actually better rest at sea level in terms of oxygen into your body, rather than coming out maybe 1 or 2 days prior, and you're at 7,000 feet, you could feel those effects of like sleep apnea essentially, because you're not used to having, it's not that it's a lack of oxygen, but the partial pressure of oxygen is
Right.
just not nearly as close. So you're not getting as great of a rest. So those were the two kinds of trains of thoughts. And I witnessed that on the last climb, Chris, not and he did it awesome and he did amazing, but he definitely had told me that like color was starting to kind of fade as we got higher and higher up. But and he was hoofing, but he was able to keep up there. Whereas I was just hoofing, but I felt like I had all the colors, and I mean it was gorgeous. So I know
Yeah.
we kind of digressed there a little
No,
bit.
it's a good point.
So yeah, all of those things, man. I mean, I had what I had. I ran the race according to that, and it was awesome, man. It was really awesome to see how much I feel like the effort that I put into this race and the research, the training, everything all paid off, up to and including my crew. So I'll just launch right into number one. I think most important part is the crew chief. And so my wife has been my crew chief for every single run that she was able to make it out. I think she only has not been there for one of them. And that was, believe it or not, it was Thailand.
Yep.
So noted, right? Anyway, she's the glue that pretty much held everything together. She had the plan. We had talked about, where I'm going to be, the pace cards. And I mean, it's such a huge job, and I owe her so much, and a lot of the success of this race is due to her for sure. I just want to make that very, very clear. And then I had a couple pacers. One of the guys, like I had mentioned, Rich, I worked with him. Jason, an old colleague that I worked with, who lives out in Colorado, he was able to join me as well. And then I had Chris come out, who was my kind of first person that really believed in my running. And he had a company, FGA, if anybody has ever heard of it, taught me a lot about ultra running and to slow down and how to be strong. And then we had a little surprise pacer come out, who's another friend of mine named Bobby. And so I had basically four pacers, and I assigned each pacer roughly about 16 miles. This race, you're able to pick up pacers around 53.7 miles to Weehawken aid station. So the first 53, which took me just under 24 hours to get to 53, just to put the perspective of what 20,000 feet of climbing in 53 miles is like. That's how long it took me. I stayed very reserved throughout the race. But yeah, so that was the crew. The base station was the RV. It worked really, really well. Even though I didn't even have time to like get inside that RV and sleep. There was just, you had to boogie, man. You had to dig deep. I had to dig deep for 51 hours and some change. I think the longest amount of time I was up and off my feet was about 20 minutes. So,
Wow.
boom. Yep, that's the crew, fully stocked with water and snacks and everything that I needed. So yeah, let's talk about start. So the start line, yep, 0800 start right out of Fallon Park. Absolutely gorgeous. I actually brought a map too, so I could speak kind of intelligently behind it. So yeah, you start out at Fallon Park and you go down these back streets and you get onto a piece of what they call the perimeter trail, and it goes all around Ouray. Such a neat area, man. Just I mean, the energy was amazing. It was a pretty clear morning. Around 80 degrees out at
Wow.
7,700 feet feels like probably 95 to 100, just because you're so close to the sun. You know, you're
Yeah.
closer to the sun, and so it definitely, you could feel it. The air is very, very dry. It was crisp out. You get onto this kind of service road. It's dirt after you get up the perimeter trail. You do go through this little tunnel where I guess at one point they were going to try to run water from the mountains into the city of Ouray, and that's why they made this tunnel. It's not really tall enough to stand up in, but you
Yep.
don't have to like crouch. You kind of just got to hunch over and run through it. It's pretty cool. But you get onto the service road, and it takes you up to the first aid station, which is the Lower Camp Bird aid station. I was thinking to myself, because there was 140 runners that started, that I was like, man, I bet the aid stations are going to be like, it's going to be a traffic jam. And they were not. The aid stations were absolutely incredible. The people that were there were so friendly and good. You know, they're like, what do you need? We're using scratch products. They had your standard food fare, peanut butter sandwiches, grapes, oranges, apples, everything that you could possibly need. I call them Licky Chewies or sugar balls, the little scratch gummies,
Yeah, but
and
the aid
very
station, the way
quick.
you described it is the aid station, they had it sectioned. So it wasn't like the food was just all on a table. They actually had it organized so that you could go, here's the fruit section, here's the peanut butter and jelly section, here's the chip section, here's the candy section, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was awesome. It's such a well-designed course. It was really, really great. And there had been some reviews too about how, you know, they're like, well, it's just a bunch of out and backs. But I'm going to tell you, the out and backs were, in my opinion, really cool, because you get to see the front of the pack. And a lot of
Yeah.
times, you know, when if you're a mid packer or you're in the back of the pack, like, you never see the elite runners up in the front. And so to watch these elite runners, just how they navigate the mountain system, is it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Men and women, there are just some really, really incredibly talented runners. And not only that, everybody's is giving encouragement. So it's going both ways. And you know, to have these elite runners, they're like, you're doing awesome, man. And you're like, you're doing awesome. It's like, it's just, we everybody fuels each other up, and the energy and the vibe was, it was just rad, man. What a rad race. It was amazing. And that's about a 2,300 foot climb up to the Lower Camp aid station. And then from there, you climb another 2,000 feet up into what's called the Silver Basin. And it's just gorgeous, man. You've got these, I sent you some of the pictures. They're
Yeah.
absolutely just amazing, where you have this they call it rock flower in the water. So the water is like this just gorgeous turquoise against these just majestic mountains. And you had all these wildflowers that are grown. You've got like mountain daisies. They're purple and they're yellow, and there's fat little marmots running around. It was, man, it was really, really neat. And the trail, you know, starts to get turned into like that four-wheel drive trail, where the footing is good, but it's rocky. And again, it goes back to, like I had said, Charles just did a really great job, the race director, of really explaining each section. So it wasn't a mystery. Yeah, I knew exactly what I was getting into. So yeah, you jam up to the Silver Shield aid station. There's a little post, and you punch your little bib. They've got certain shapes in it, and then back down you go to the Camp Bird aid station. Once you get there, you know, refueled, jammed back up, and you climb up. It's fairly steep, and the section wasn't too bad, but you go up to what's called the Richmond aid station. In my opinion, Richmond aid station was one of my favorites, man. They had dino nuggies there, chicken nuggets. For me, I've never eaten chicken nuggets before in a race, and I was
Right.
like, I'm gonna try it, and I'm gonna tell you what, they worked well.
Awesome.
And I know that kind of goes against the cardinal rule, but I think after doing, you know, eight of these bad boys, 100 miles plus, and I'm not tooting my horn on that. I'm just simply saying that sometimes you're like, you know what, I'm gonna try it, you know, and if it comes
Yeah.
up, it comes up. But they didn't. They worked, and I felt really, really well fueled. So it's starting to get warmer now, and this particular aid station kind of preps you for really, really tough the next two sections. It's one section, but it's two pretty massive climbs. And you go up to the Chicago Tunnel, and then from the Chicago Tunnel, you get back on to the Imogene Pass, which when you get to the top of Imogene Pass, it's not good enough to just get to the top of the pass. There's about another 300-foot talus mountain that you climb all the way up to the top till you get to what's called Fort Peabody. And when you get up to the top, you look over, you can see Telluride, the whole entire mountain.
Yep.
You can see the airport down there. It's amazing. But man, there's no air. Like there was it's 13,400 feet. It definitely was hard to breathe. About halfway up, so Chicago climb, I think, was by far, for me anyway, it was just that portion of the race. I mean, my legs were just on fire, and that's where the battle started for me, really. Where my mind started to just think about all the other climbs, and I quickly just told myself, like, hey, dude, shush it. Like, shush your mouth. Like, just quiet down.
Yeah.
Let's just get to the top of this, and then let's get down. And that was kind of my game plan from the mental standpoint, how I was going to run this race. That's how I had to kind of chunk it down, because if you thought about the cumulative overall, how much climbing you had left, I think that could, if that gets in your head, you could have a really hard race.
Right.
So I just tried to chunk it down and make it into, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One little bite at a time, right? And this is
Yep.
definitely an elephant. So that worked. And then after that, what was really neat is we started to get some cloud cover. And that really cooled it down. It was neat from a temperature perspective. It would go from you want to take your shirt off, you're sweating, to all of a sudden that cloud comes over, it'll drop, you know, 15, 20 degrees. And, you know, if the wind picks up, it felt very, very nice. I don't like the heat. I like the cold. I'd rather be cold than hot.
Yep.
And so for pretty much the rest of that afternoon, we had some kind of off and on cloud cover. So it was nice. And I pushed it when the clouds came over, and then I just kind of slowed it down when the sun was out to just kind of manage that piece on how much, you know, water I was carrying. And yeah, once you get back down to, you finish those two climbs, and they were tough.
And what mile are you at now, once you've finished those two climbs?
After those two climbs, when you get back down to the Richmond aid station, you're just over 20 miles. And
Okay.
I didn't feel smoked yet. That's coming up here, but I could start to feel it. Like I could feel I was working. So the next piece, I think, was probably one of the most difficult climbs. And that's going from the Richmond aid station, you go up and over Richmond Pass. And when I tell people this, like you're going over a mountain pass into a totally different mountain system. That's the magnitude of these climbs. And everything changes, the scenery. And so on this particular climb, it literally looks like somebody just jetted a path straight up the side of this mountain. And then it starts to zigzag. And this is the first time where the footing is good, but you're on this just very weird, steep grade. And that's when I think I really started to feel it in my knees. But I was thankful for all of the training on Mount Trashmore, running sideways along that mountain. That's one of the things that definitely helped me to be successful and prepared me for these next kind of couple pieces. You get up to the top of Richmond Pass, and it's absolutely gorgeous. I mean, the view of Ironton Mountain you can see where you're going to run around next, and you run around almost the, this huge 8 mile section of this mountain, and you can see the path and the roads down below you, and it is just neat, man. It's really, really neat. And when you get down into the Ironton aid station, you're at 27 miles now, and that's really when I think that's the first kind of big hit where I just felt the cumulative mileage. You've done about 10,000 feet of climbing and about just 9,000 feet of descent in a marathon
In a marathon.
distance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In a marathon. That's a key point. And 27 was where there were a lot of people that just said, "Man, I'm in over my head," and dropped there. So, to get past that point had to be a little bit of a mental victory.
Absolutely. I could see, like, when you check in at every aid station, you would check in, and they had a really great system. You would check in with your number, and then they would be like, "Okay, Kyle," and you would be like, "That's me," and they're like, "Roger that, go, like, time, get on out or whatever you need. Thank you for checking in." And you could start to see people's trackers, because you were required to carry a tracker here.
Right.
They had this table, and there was probably, I don't know, f 15 trackers on that table. And I just remember looking down at there, and I was like, "I'm not putting my tracker on that table. Like, it ain't happening." I think even for people to just do that, that's a pretty good first attempt if something happened, or maybe they got injured, et cetera. But that's a heck of a lot of climbing in a marathon distance.
And I think what had to be daunting is coming down from the top of Richmond Pass, you're able to see everything you're about to climb on the Ironton, right?
I mean, that's way off in the distance, but yeah, you're like, "Oh my gosh, I gotta go all the way around that mountain system." Like,
Well,
and then I gotta come back up and over this pass the
exactly,
opposite
because
direction.
you know what you're about to go down. You're gonna climb it in a little bit.
You're gonna climb it. You're gonna
Yep.
climb it. Crazy. So
Yeah.
again, I think a critical piece is, like, it's just calming your mind down and just being like, "Dude, let's just take this one little section at a time, or even a half of a section, right? Like, let's just get to the top and then get back down. Boom, one section complete."
Yep.
Yeah, for sure. So I had a planned stop in Ironton, and Tanya was there. We had the camper. She had everything out. I was going to squeeze my legs. But man, when I saw them, I just got this rush of energy. I had some more Dino Nuggies. I had a little cheese quesadilla. Aid station folks, again, super nice. I told Tanya, "Hey, I'm gonna go for it. Like, I'm gonna go for it, and I'm gonna try to do both loops. And then before I go up and over Richmond Pass again, because it's gonna be nighttime again at this point, then I'll plan on a squeeze." So the crew was like, "Roger that. Like, that sounds like a great plan." And I was about probably 1 hour and 20 minutes ahead of my pace card that I had written, my projected time. I felt great. Obviously some lows here and there, but then energy would come back. When I left the Ironton aid station, you do basically one loop counterclockwise, and then you do a clockwise loop. So I ended up cranking through that first loop pretty quick. I think I had factored in around 3 hours and 15 minutes, and I think I did it in about 3 hours. And
Yeah, but describe this loop. So just in case, because especially us Flatlanders, we think, okay, so it's just a loop, right? But this isn't just a loop. Describe what you're doing on this loop.
Okay, so this loop is 8.1 miles, and it's just shy of 2,800 feet of gain and loss in 8 miles. So yeah, you're
Oh,
doing a
it's not
significant,
just a loop.
it's not just a loop. It's a loop with a pretty sweet amount of elevational gain. Yeah, and descent for sure. Yeah. So this is cool too, because I ran into, and I hope I don't botch the name, but there was a photographer that was out there taking pictures, and her name was Ezra, and she was a hoot. Very friendly, awesome energy. Took some fantastic photos for the runners to buy later on. And she took a couple pictures of me with the Ironton Mountain, a backdrop.
Oh,
And it's amazing.
wow.
Yeah, dude. And I bought it, and it's incredible. But just the staff of the race, the people that were out there doing their livelihood, everybody was just amazing on that race. And I just wanted to make that highlight. And yeah, just chit-chatted for a few minutes, and then off I went. And then on the end of that loop, it turned into nighttime. The lights went down, and I actually had prepped and carried my headlamp. I made kind of a critical error. I run with the Kogala,
Yep.
and I had my just, my regular Black Diamond headlamp in there. And I wish that I would not have taken the Kogala, because I finished that loop and I only was in the dark for maybe probably about like 30 minutes. And it was like twilighty, if that makes sense. So
Yep.
I had essentially carried those Kogalas are not light, about an extra pound of weight. I should have just grabbed it on the second loop. But yeah, got to the aid station, and I felt really good. And I was, Tanya's like, do you need to squeeze? What do you need? And I just kind of did a R8 roll, that R8 roller on my legs, and
Yeah.
then fueled up, and boom, back up and over the opposite direction. This was neat, and I wanted to share this at one point. Now it's obviously dark, and I got to the top of where the Ironton Mountain piece is. When you're going one direction, and then now you're going to go, down the backside of it and around. And I turned off my headlamp, and it was clear. I mean, the sky was so clear. It was about probably 50 degrees. I'm at probably 10,000 feet or so, maybe 10,700, 11,000, somewhere in there, just above tree line. I turn off my light, and man, Mike, I felt like I was swimming in the stars. I mean,
Wow.
it was beautiful. It
Yeah.
was
Is that the point
absolutely
where you
beautiful.
just said, wow, this is what they mean by the heavens declare the glory of
Oh,
God,
the
huh?
glory of God, and the expanse is talking about his handiwork. Like,
Yeah.
I mean, day to day pours forth speech, and night after night reveals knowledge. The stars, they don't even have to say anything. They're just handing out, like they're just showing his glory. It was neat. It was neat. Sorry, I got a little
No,
teary
that's
eyed there.
awesome.
It was a beautiful moment. And
Yeah.
man, yeah, after that, like I started cooking. It was all downhill, and I had a really nice pace, zip back around, and I think I did it in about the same amount of time, right at about
Oh,
3 hours.
wow.
Pretty consistent. And
So
so
now,
yeah,
once you
checked
get down Ironton, what you're are you like at 40 miles now? 40-something miles?
in. Yeah, so the at when I'm at Ironton, ready to head back up and over Richmond Pass, I'm about 43 and yeah, 43 and a half miles or so.
Okay.
Yeah, so I did a Normatec squeeze here. I tried to sleep, but I was so excited. I had abstained from caffeine. I love coffee. And I about a week prior, I stopped drinking, and I had very little intake, if not any at all. I think I snuck a cup of coffee in at U-Ray because I was like, man, I just need a cup. It's because the head was
And
kind of
that's
messing with me.
actually a huge tip for those people that are going to be doing something where you know you're going to be out there at least one night and possibly two nights, running around, abstaining from coffee and the caffeine for a week is actually very beneficial, because now all of a sudden the caffeine, when you do take it in, does something, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I was wired for sound. I was tired, but I had I was using some Spring Energy, which, man, that's a fantastic product. If nobody has ever used it, certainly do your research during your training runs. But they had, I think it was called Hill Aid. It's about 100 and or maybe 250 calories, and it's got about 50 milligrams of caffeine in it. And just like you said, because I had, abstained from that caffeine, the effect of it like kept me awake. I felt like I was awake. So that tiredness that you experience kind of during what I call the witching hours of the night around 2, 3 o'clock, I never really felt that. I felt strong all the way through, which was amazing. So yeah,
Well,
I
and that's
used
a
to.
tip that I learned from Chris. You probably got it from the same source, right? Was
I got it from the same source, Chris.
Yep,
Fantastic.
yep.
Yeah, I definitely give him the credit.
This is why we love
So,
Chris. He has
yes,
little tips.
we love Chris. Absolutely. I love it. Yeah. So, yeah, back up and over Richmond Pass. And, it was funny because you're talking to some other runners, and they're like, this is bananas, man. This climb, it was so steep, man. Coming out, and I think it's just the residual effect. And even Charles, he makes mention of this section. He goes, it's not that it's the most technical difficult section. He goes, but all of the cumulative effect of what you have been running is starting to catch up. And now we're nearing at this particular point here. We're at 16,500 feet of climbing that you've done, and you're about to climb another 2,800 feet straight up, and then about 4,000 feet, 5,000 feet down. So your body's
Wow.
feeling, yeah, it's bananas, man. I mean, it really is. I still kind of am in awe that my body, like I am, but I'm not, because I know where my strength comes from. And I had prepared for this, and it just worked out well. It was one of those races that just everything lined up well, and it was awesome. So yeah, got all the way down, and now you're getting into the Weehawken aid station, where you get to pick up your first pacer.
And
And
that's
yeah,
always a great feeling, isn't it?
it is so awesome. Yeah, it really is. And what's amazing too is the pacers that I had chose for each section were very appropriate. Because I think one of the worst things is if you choose that pacer that's just overly ambitious. It's not that they mean to do it on purpose, but they'll take your energy, and you're like,
Yeah.
"I no, dude, I need your energy." So I think that you got to pick the right pacer for each section. Yeah, it worked out. It worked out perfect, man. So, yep, up and down Alpine Pass.
And who was
As
your first pacer?
far as, yeah, first pacer was Jason.
Awesome.
Yep, so it's called the Alpine Mine Overlook, and it's a 2,300 foot climb. I just say a little one, but honestly, this was the first climb where I'm thinking to myself, man, this is kind of an enjoyable climb. And I don't know if it's just because all the other stuff was so ridiculous. Like, it's like ridiculously steep. It was like a little piece of relief. Looking back, I'm doing the math and I'm like, well, it's really not. I mean, it was 2,300 feet and 2.5 miles up, which is quite a bit. But I guess it's just the way that the path curved, and also I had a pacer, right? So I've got more energy. I'm feeling good. So that probably helped to make that particular section feel a little bit more manageable. Yeah, got down there, and then I picked up another pacer. It was Rich, and he had the task of taking me up and over Hayden Pass. And this, by far, I think was, well, I was starting to struggle. Now I'm right around the 60-mile mark. You got to go up and over Hayden Pass. It's a 3,600 foot climb. It's relentless and it's steep. You get a couple sections where your feet are slipping a little bit, but the trail is still mountain trail. We got some afternoon rain, and it's daylight, so it's hot. You got to slow down, and then boom, the clouds come over. You can start to move. We had rain jackets on, rain jackets off. Let's stay under these trees for a minute. I'm out of air. I can't breathe. You're going through the dirty 60s, just lows. And I picked the right pacer, who was just fantastic, man. Stayed by my side, let me lead. Didn't try to push me, because he could just see that I was going through a rough spot. And it definitely, this is where I started to slow down. It took almost an hour longer for me to get up and over, but I had the time. But now, you're starting to kind of see the, like, you're like, okay, I'm halfway through the course now. And these cutoffs are starting to kind of become a real reality. And they were very, very strict about the cutoffs, and rightfully so, because if you didn't meet those cutoffs, if you didn't start certain sections by certain times, you're not going to make it. You're just not going to make it. It's the course is that hard. It's very, very difficult. And so I understand that, and they were more than fair. I still was about an hour ahead of the cutoffs, but that's certainly something that was now floating in my mind, and kind of robbing me a little bit of my power, because I was like, man, I don't want to miss these cutoffs. I started to kind of get some hot spots here when I got down to Crystal Lake, and that was another aid station. My whole crew was there, which was fantastic. I got to see all of the pacers and everything, because at Weehawken, it's only pacers, no actual crew. So we did a quick shoe swap. Decided to change some shoes into some old trusties. I was running in the Lone Peaks, which is a fantastic shoe. Not a whole lot of cushion, but I like to be able to feel the trail, and I think those shoes worked really, really well for me. Changed some socks. Chris actually took a look at my feet, and he's like, "Dude, your feet look great." I had no blisters, really, just kind of some hot spots, but I was concerned that they could potentially turn into blisters, and I've got 40 miles to go, right? Like, I can nug through 20, but boy, 40, that's a different story if you
Yeah,
start
that's
getting
a
some
huge
nasty
ask.
blisters. But the feet were good. Put on a fresh pair of socks, and then guess what? The sky fell out, lightning, thunder.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, I just changed my shoes, man.
I just put clean socks and shoes on, man.
So I remember saying a little prayer, and I know there's probably people out there that are like, whatever, but if it's in God's will, it is. And sure enough, man, just as fast as the rain came, it went away.
That's awesome.
And I was like, let's go. And we hit the trail and back up and over Hayden Pass. And then all the way down into Fallon Park. Yeah, it's almost a 45, it's a 4,500 foot descent. You can feel it. And I mean, at one point, it feels like my tibia and my fibia are smashing through my kneecaps into my femurs. Like, that's when I got into Fallon Park, I had to sit in a chair for a minute. Like, that one hurt. And to put that into perspective, I'm right around 74 and a half miles. So 74 and a half miles, they had pizza, man. Fallon Park aid station was
There you
also
go.
fantastic. They had that little tiny pizza oven. They're like, you want some pizza? And I'm like, what? Yeah. Dude, I had pizza. One of my buddies, Art, who was out there, he was driving down the road and saw me. He's like, dude, do you want a burger? And I was like, I
Oh
would love a
my
burger.
gosh,
So I
that's awesome.
yes. Yeah, I crushed half of a burger, piece of pizza. I got up off my feet for about 20 minutes or so, and then I did a shoe swap here, because I was like, all right, I need something with more cushion. So then I went into the Timp 5s, fantastic shoe, but certainly a greater stack height in the shoe. And I could definitely feel that translating as I was running. I could feel, my gait. I had to change it up a little bit, but the cushion was amazing. It felt like my feet were brand new. I wanted to just throw out there, I love doing that right around, 70, 80 miles. It's these little tiny things. And I brushed my teeth. I was like, I want to
Oh,
brush my
there you
teeth.
go. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, just getting that filth of the sugar off of your teeth.
Oh, yeah, because you've been moving for what, 40 hours at this point?
So like this next climb, we're prepping for nighttime again. It's going to be nighttime. And so the next climb, which I think it's equally as bad, Hayden Pass was I think the most. It was about 1,300 feet per mile of climbing and descent. That's just to put that into perspective, how steep that terrain is. And then this next piece, almost the same. I mean, it was bananas the way that this trail goes. And you go up to the top of, it's called Twin Peaks, and you get to the top of Twin Peaks. And this is also a trail that I had checked out prior to, because the race director was like, highly recommend you check this out so you don't get lost, because there's a couple turns in there. And we had only done half of it, and my thought was, this is crazy how steep this is. Like, this is nuts. And little did I realize that that was only half of the climb. There was still another 1,700 feet to go.
Oh boy.
So yeah, I just kept thinking to myself, like, this is ridiculous. This is, and you're just tired. You're at 74 miles. I'm fighting against the 1 hour Grim Reaper cutoffs. Anyway, get up to the top there. You have to like scramble up to the top of these rocks. You just take your pack and your poles off and go up like another maybe 75 feet. But
But it's a
beautiful.
rock climb.
It's a little rock climb. It's a little rock climb, and you get to the top and you can see the town of Ouray, and now the sun is setting. Gorgeous. We got this picture of this background, and I mean, the rocks are just this majestic red. I mean, it was amazing to see it. And picture, like, you take a picture of some of these things, they just don't even do it justice. Like, you got to be there. It was incredible. And I'll look for that picture to try to get it to you. But so boom, back down there, knocked it out. Now, I actually felt really, really, really good. Finished that whole section. Again, a lot of climbing.
And
You
who's
go a
pacing
different.
you at this point? Who's with
Yeah,
you?
it's it, so it's Jason is my pacer for the next section. And it's called Twin Peaks, and then you go to Silver Shield, and then you go Silver Shield back up, but then you go down that just super gnarly steep climb that, junks into the Twin Peaks climb, back to Fallon Park.
So this is Fallon Park 2, right?
This is Fallon Park the second time.
Okay.
So picked up a new pacer. This is Bobby. This was his section. It was Chief Ure Mine, 6.7 miles. Pretty good climb, 3,400 feet up, 3,400 feet down. And the backside of the course is not as high, but the climbs are more severe, if that makes sense. The elevation per mile gets stronger. And that was actually enjoyable. At one point, during the witching hour, I almost fell off the trail, and Bobby grabbed my arm and pulled me back. I was like, dude, thank you, buddy. Like, and it would have been a bad fall for sure. Finished that bad boy, and then the sun is just about to come back up. So to put that in perspective, that's two full nights of running.
So this
And
will be your second sunrise, right?
this would be my second sunrise. Yep, second
Wow.
sunrise. So the sun is up. I'm with Chris now. Chris is my final pacer. Man, he's such a great pacer. Everybody was great, but Chris just brings a whole nother kind of level of, he's excited for you and he wants you to succeed. He will do the talking. You just have to listen and just miles will click off, man. And I met this one guy on the trail, and it's neat, right? Because you're seeing, again, the elites have already finished, but you're seeing like kind of still some of the people that are, 5 hours in front of you that are coming down the mountain, because that Bridge of Heaven piece is it's 4,850 feet of climbing and descent, right? Just to bury the hatchet in 10.6 miles. And I remember this one gentleman, and I was like, I got this, like I'm getting that buckle, like I got this race, man. And the guy looks at me and he goes, at the time I thought he was kind of being somewhat pompous and a jerk. He's like, you better climb and you better not stop. And I was like, well, I plan on it, sir. And I didn't even get his name. And everybody's tired. And I didn't realize it until I got to a certain point on that Bridge of Heaven climb. And I'm thinking to myself, where, like, the top has to be right here. And Chris is like, the top has to be right there. And we get through these trees, and I see this mountain peak off in the distance, and I see little people, like little tiny stick figures climbing it, like zigzagging up it. And I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, Chris, we gotta go. I was like, dude, we gotta go. I just remember Chris looking at me. He's like, dude, get going. I'm right behind you. I'm feeling the effects of the altitude, but I'm right behind you. I don't want to slow you down. Get going. And he kept up the whole entire time. He was just behind me, and I got into my head and just started power hiking up, and I got to the top of that thing, and Mike, oh,
What a feeling, huh?
it was probably one of the most beautiful things I think I've ever seen in my life. And the sun's out, it's hot again, you're just totally exposed, but you can see the whole, you could just see everything, like where you've been running and the mountain systems, and it was something. And I had a little moment up there, and I tied my shoes and down we went, man. It took me 4 hours to climb that. And it took me about, I boogied down in about 2 hours. So that was it, man. When I got to the bottom of that climb, you kind of get on this road, the Million Dollar Highway. You run up just a skirt piece of it, and you go into Phelan Park. And man, I'm telling you, I felt like I was running 6 minute miles. And to watch the video, I might have been making like 12:30s, maybe.
Felt sick though, man.
Dude, and I came across the finish line. You've seen it, dude. And I jumped up as high as I could in the air, and it felt like 10 feet, but it was probably 8 inches, maybe six. And then my legs, dude, they just gave out. Like, they gave out.
The landing was beautiful.
I like took two steps in my like to try to recover, and my body was just laughing at me.
Oh
Amazing.
my gosh. Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Like, what an accomplishment. It was so neat. It was cool. It's cool to push your body. I mean, I can't even describe how I felt and how I still feel today. It's unbelievable. And my whole crew was there to give me hugs. And and the recovery, which is so crazy, is like, I mean, I couldn't believe I I was not as sore as I thought I was going to
Right.
be. I thought that I was going to be just hammered, and I wasn't. And I think maybe it's just the cumulative effect. They always say, right, that every 100 you do, the recovery gets faster, and it's
Yep.
and your body, responds or it heals faster. I was sore, but not terribly sore. I mean, not like the like Bryce Canyon.
Exactly.
Ooh, I was in
Boy,
trouble.
it's been a journey, man. From Bryce Canyon to U-Ray, and what a journey, Kyle.
Yeah, man. Thank you, buddy, and thanks for having me on here. And I
You
hope
got it.
that anybody that's listening can get some helpful tips.
Absolutely. There's so many nuggets in this thing, man. I would listen to this podcast with a pen and a piece of paper because there's little nuggets that you threw out there throughout this. So what's in Kyle Vanek's future?
Yeah, well, man, I'm starting to really feel everything, and I'm gonna start slowing it down. I think I got some 50Ks and some 50 milers in there, but I think the big ones are done. I say that I think that I'm really gonna not do big 100 milers. Just the training, it takes so much time, and although I enjoy it, there's other stuff out there to do. And I'm still gonna always run. I just don't think I'll be running, multi-day races anymore. But
There you
I want
go.
to help out. You know what I mean? I was thinking maybe a race director. I'd like to start a race out here. I think that'd be great. There's not a lot of big, like, I don't think there's any, like, besides the Swami Shuffle, which is an amazing race. Highly recommend you run it. I'll always pace, and I love that kind of aspect of it. So I think I'm kind of in that position where I just kind of want to give back now a little bit.
Awesome. Good stuff. Okay, well, this
Yeah,
is the
man.
way we always wrap up the Living an Ultra Life podcast. As you know, the name of it is Living an Ultra Life. What's the first thing that pops in your head when you hear that?
Living an ultra life, it is a way of life. It's when things get difficult, you see the big picture, and then just kind of start to nug down how you could navigate that and be successful in it. And I think that there's some great principles that tie into ultra running that you can utilize throughout your life each and every day.
Good
I
stuff, Kyle. Thank you
think
so much for taking a little time.
yeah, man. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening. Really appreciate you guys. We'll see you next time on Living an Ultra Life.